From Arizona to Massachusetts, Hawaii to Texas, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, government programs have failed to bring about integrated housing in many American cities. For a look at the nation's efforts at expanding fair housing, we talk with UCLA law professor Richard Sander. The primary season is about to hit high gear. Andy Roth from the Club for Growth has the real story on Republican chances to retain control of the U.S. Congress. Lobbyists give money to politicians who grant them access. That shocking statement got one high-ranking Trump administration official in hot water. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details. And there is a backlog of judicial nominees awaiting Senate confirmation. On this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says the solution is for the Senate to work harder. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The federal government has tried to foster integration in housing since 1968. Those programs have made housing more fair, but many cities remain largely segregated along racial lines. Richard Sander is a law professor at UCLA, and he is co-author of the book Moving Toward Integration. He joins us now to explain why integration has social and economic benefits. Richard, welcome to American Radio Journal. Richard, when we look at the issue of integration, you in your book, you and your co-authors, part of the thrust of the book is that you are saying that African Americans are not advancing and are not fully participating in the benefits of American life because of a lack of integration. How is it that segregation causes racial inequality?
Segregation has manifold effects upon black life. Housing segregation tends to lead to bigger separation in the schools, and for whatever reasons, black schools tend to have lower quality teaching and so on than white schools do. Segregation separates blacks more from jobs, and we see that in areas that have lower segregation, black unemployment rates are much lower, and blacks have higher quality jobs. And it sort of creates two cultures. When a city has significant integration, white and black norms and white and black behaviors become more similar to each other. And that seems to have beneficial effects generally, but it particularly means that young African Americans have an easier time fitting into American society and succeeding.
When we look at the issue of fair housing and segregation, 50 years ago, the federal government passed the Fair Housing Act. Here we are, half a century later, the problem persists. Is it possible for government to really have an impact, a meaningful impact on integrated housing?
Well, that's one of the most interesting stories in the book. The original Fair Housing Act was aimed at housing discrimination, not segregation. So it was trying to stop landlords and real estate brokers from refusing to serve African Americans in white areas. And that problem was actually pretty effectively addressed, defined through a variety of methods, that about two-thirds of discrimination against blacks in the housing market disappeared in the 10 years after the Fair Housing Act. And since then, it has continued to erode. So discrimination, we've made great progress on. And I think the assumption in the 1960s was that if you got rid of discrimination, then integration would automatically follow. But that's proven to be the case only in maybe 10% of America's urban population.
When you look at integration, and of course, housing, a large component of that is where people might choose to live. Richard, if we look back through American history, we've had wave after wave of immigrants who've come into this country. Immigrants have tended to cluster around like-minded individuals. I grew up in southwestern Pennsylvania. There were Irish neighborhoods and there were Italian neighborhoods. Now we have a wave of Hispanic immigrants. They're clustering together. Is this more a matter of people like to be around people of their own ethnic, religious, racial backgrounds and therefore do not self-integrate?
Well, that certainly has something to do with it. But the black situation has been unique. There's an index we use where zero represents complete integration in a metro area and 100 is complete apartheid. And if you look at, say, the story of Italian Americans, when they first arrived, they had indices of similarity around 70 or 80. But every decade that they were here, that index went down. They went through what we call a assimilation, where the new generations would come along and they'd be more likely to intermarry with non-Italians. Some of them would convert from Catholicism to Protestantism. They would regularly move into more areas that were non-Italian. So those indices steadily went down, and most ethnic groups end up somewhere around 30, which means that there's still identifiable Italian neighborhoods, but most Italians don't live in them. So with blacks, it's different. And with blacks, they've been in cities for well over 100 years, and we have many urban areas, Chicago, New York, St. Louis, Milwaukee, where that index of segregation is still above 80. So something different is happening with African Americans. And a lot of it is that when blacks move into a neighborhood, and this was more true 30 years ago than today, people notice and people sometimes change their behavior based on those moves. It's much easier for tipping to occur when people look as differently as blacks and whites do. A lot of African Americans are sort of locked into networks where the housing they find out about is mostly through other blacks. And so they disproportionately tend to make moves into other black neighborhoods. So there are a lot of self-sustaining mechanisms that apply to blacks that haven't applied to other American ethnic groups.
As we look at this issue, Richard, is this sort of a chicken and egg type of thing? Which came first? If you look at a lot of neighborhoods that are majority African American, overwhelmingly so, a lot of times those neighborhoods are in urban areas with poor or failing school systems. How big of a role does educational achievement and, more importantly, educational opportunity play in this?
It's obviously really important, and we're not going to make big advances with black outcomes until education improves. But we think that, on balance, housing segregation is a much more powerful way to fight educational problems than the other way around. The 60s and 70s, we tried a lot of very aggressive strategies for desegregating schools. And many of those things had temporary success, but generally not long-term success. And a reason was that housing patterns tended to reassert themselves and lead to resegregation of the schools. Whereas in the urban areas that have gone through housing integration, and as I say, there are a fair number of them, although there are still a minority of cities, school integration always follows housing integration and it remains stable. It doesn't shift back. Once a city is substantially housing integrated, there's no instance to know where it has become, on a city level, resegregated. And in those metro areas, you also see a lot of convergence of blacks towards white test score levels. You see higher school completion rates, and you see much higher employment among African-American teenagers. So it really seems that housing is the key driver. If you're going to get at a root cause, if there's one thing you can change that's going to make other reforms happen, it's black housing segregation.
And then does this become, and you've noted in your book, an optimism that we can improve integration without a lot of social engineering. Does this become sort of like a boulder rolling downhill that it gains steam, that once you have more integration, then you have better educational opportunities for folks of all racial backgrounds?
Yeah, that's sure the way that it looks. There were, as I say, about a dozen metro areas that for special demographic reasons really had significant drops in segregation right after the Fair Housing Act was passed. And all those areas had this rolling stone phenomenon where it kept feeding on itself, and those areas are all pretty well integrated today. So the key policy strategy now is to kind of consciously think about how can we bring about sort of conditions that existed in those cities and generate enough integration that it'll start being self-sustaining.
We have been talking with Richard Sander, who is a professor of law at UCLA. He's also an economist, and he's co-author of the book Moving Toward Integration, The Past and Future of Fair Housing. Richard, if we have listeners who would like to learn more about this issue, where to buy the book, where can they go?
We have a website called movingtowardintegration.com.
Richard Sander, co-author of the book Moving Toward Integration. Richard, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Great speaking with you. Thank you.
At the Club for Growth in Washington, D.C., Andy Roth is keeping an eye on political races all across the country. This year, of course, we have races for the United States Senate and United States House of Representatives. We're going to take a step back and do an overview today. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Let's start out with the United States Senate, a razor-thin Republican majority in the United States Senate. What is shaping up as the possibility for Republicans being able to hold on to that edge or maybe even increase it a bit?
Well, typically the first midterm election after a new president is elected, the opposing party usually is favored. So in this case, the Democrats should have the advantage in the midterms because of Trump's election. And that is certainly the case in the House, but thankfully that's not the case in the Senate. Right now, Republicans have a 51-49 advantage in the upper chamber, but there are 26 seats held by Democrats that are up for election, while only 9 seats held by Republicans. More importantly, you can winnow that down even further. There are about 10, 11 of those 26 Dem seats that are competitive, while with Republicans, there are 2, maybe 3. So if Republicans are able to safely save those 3 seats and then maybe pick up 1, 2 or more of the Dem seats, then they're going to come out on top and they'll be able to expand their majority. That's the overview, but there's obviously a lot of races in there that we could talk about.
As we look at the United States Senate, as you've mentioned, there are more Democrat seats up than Republican seats. We do have a number of states where Donald Trump won and carried that state by a large margin in the presidential election. Can you touch on some of those states and where the pickup opportunities might be for Republicans?
Some of these states are just absolutely ripe for a Republican pickup. Like in West Virginia, Joe Manchin, Democrat, holds that seat, but Trump won West Virginia by double digits, huge double digits. And same thing in North Dakota, and then to a lesser extent in Missouri and Indiana, and then Florida and Ohio and Wisconsin and Michigan and Montana. So the list goes on and on and on. In a lot of these states, there are Republican primaries, but those are going to get settled very soon. West Virginia is going to be the first one to be settled. So for the next 6 months, there will be a clear Republican candidate in some of these races fighting against the Democrat. And you're going to see a lot of money spent in those races. And I think things will look very, very good for Republicans. With one caveat, Democrats are highly motivated. They don't like Trump, they don't like Republicans, and they want them defeated. And so they are very motivated to show up at the polls. Meanwhile, Republicans are a little frustrated and disenchanted with what's going on in D.C. They love Trump. They love what he's doing. They love that he's pushing a conservative agenda, but they can't stand how Congress is so dysfunctional. So it's possible that a lot of them could stay home and give the Democrats the advantage. That is the nut that needs to be cracked by the Republican Party if they want to win these seats.
The Democrats, though, Andy, have a pickup opportunity in the U.S. Senate in a couple of states as well?
Yeah. Jeff Flake in Arizona, of course, announced his retirement. So there's a very competitive race there where the Democrats have recruited a very good candidate. So there's a pickup there. In Nevada, Senator Dean Heller, Republican, is very vulnerable. In fact, if I had to guess of all the races, I suspect he's the one most likely to lose. And then finally, Tennessee. This is a bit of a surprise, but Bob Corker, a moderate Republican, announced his retirement. Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn announced her candidacy. She's cleared the field, so she's the only Republican in the race. She's going to go head-to-head with the former Democrat governor, Phil Bredesen. And you would think this would be pretty easy, but Bredesen's legacy and his reputation in the state is of a blue dog, moderate Democrat. And I think at the end of the day, voters aren't going to buy into that just because Tennessee is such a conservative state. But right now, it does seem to be a competitive race.
We only have a minute or two left, Andy, so let's switch over to the U.S. House of Representatives. Democrat chances of taking control of that chamber much better than the Senate?
Yeah, it is. I think they need to only pick up 22 or 23 seats. It's hard to say what the exact number is because there's actually a few vacancies right now that mess with the margins. But yeah, the Democrats are focused very closely on a lot of moderate districts held by moderate Republicans in moderate states like New Jersey, New York, Illinois, and California. So as a political junkie, if you're watching the election results on election night, if you look at those four states and you see Republicans losing in the House, then that's a sure sign that the Democrats are going to pick up the majority. Now, Trump's approval numbers are actually improving, and the generic ballot is actually improving in Republicans' favor. So while many people are predicting a Democrat wave, it may be working against them right now. And with the passage of the tax cut bill, which I still firmly believe is going to be wildly popular by the fall, I think those all work in Republicans' favor. So there is still a chance that they can keep the majority.
Well, it is only May and several lifetimes before we get to an election in November. So we'll continue to keep track of all of this throughout the summer with Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. And Andy, tell us a bit about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, we'll check in with you again next week.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
So money influences politics and therefore public policy. That's not exactly an earth-shaking revelation, but it did cause a bit of a kerfuffle when one Trump administration official said it out loud. We learn more now from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
I doubt that anyone listening would be surprised by the claim that lobbyists have influence in government or the claim that campaign contributions can make politicians more likely to listen to lobbyists. But a few weeks ago, we had to go through an entire 24-hour news cycle of outrage pretending that these two basic truths of politics were somehow not true. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look back at what landed Mick Mulvaney in some hot water a couple of weeks ago. Mulvaney, of course, is the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and he's also the head of the White House's Office of Management and Budget, and he may very well be Donald Trump's next chief of staff, if you believe some of the rumors. Now, he landed in hot water 2 weeks ago for saying on camera and in front of an audience that lawmakers are more likely to listen to lobbyists who have made political contributions to them. And it is true, of course, that lawmakers are more likely to listen to lobbyists who have made political contributions. If that weren't true, one would be left to wonder exactly why so many unions, corporations, and special interest groups cut so many massive checks to members of Congress every 2 years. Specifically, what Mulvaney said, referring back to his time as a member of Congress, while speaking to a gathering of bankers in Washington, D.C., was this. Quote, we had a hierarchy in my office in Congress. If you're a lobbyist and you never gave us money, I didn't talk to you. If you're a lobbyist who gave us money, I might talk to you. End quote. Those 36 words are being treated as proof positive that Mulvaney is bought and paid for by whatever powerful special interest was able to write a check with the most zeros on them. The swamp has won. The game is rigged. Democrats in Congress have called for Mulvaney's resignation. Senator Elizabeth Warren, who designed the all-powerful financial regulator that Mulvaney now runs, has said that those remarks are proof that the Trump administration is the most corrupt in American history. Warren might very well be right. The president playing golf and receiving foreign dignitaries at country clubs and resorts that he personally owns is something unprecedented in American history. But that conclusion has little, if anything, to do with Mulvaney's admission of something that anyone who pays attention to politics already knows. In fact, Mulvaney's comments are perfectly in line with his boss's real politic talk on the relationship between money and political power. Remember back when then-candidate Donald Trump was asked during the GOP primary debates about his history of donations to Bill and Hillary Clinton? That's a cardinal sin in the Republican Party, and it was supposed to expose Trump as a phony Republican, but he just shrugged and gave an honest answer. I give to everybody, he said. When they call, I give. And you know what? When I need something from them 2 years or 3 years from now, I call them, and they are there for me. And that's not the only time Trump has said something like that. This is the way he views the relationship between money and power, and he's not wrong. That moment in the primaries was treated briefly as if it should somehow disqualify Trump from the campaign, as if the requirement for being president is an implicit agreement to go along with the lies that we've all agreed to tell ourselves about modern American politics. The idea that campaign contributions don't influence policymaking belongs right up there with the idea that entitlements are solvent or that America has achievable foreign policy goals in the Middle East. In fact, some of the most significant friction between Trump and the Washington elite have been over the lies that the president sometimes refuses to tell, rather than the obvious ones that he does tell. And maybe there's some value to maintaining this illusion. People like Jonathan Chait have argued that you have to have this to have trust in government. The government might always give donors more influence over their decisions, but at least politicians and public are supposed to pretend that's not the case. But wasn't that always the best argument for voting for Trump? He's brash, chaotic, and in over his head, but lots of Americans went to the polls and said they preferred that to Hillary Clinton, who's basically an anthropomorphic facade in a pantsuit. More to the point, if our politics have become corrupted by this pay-to-play mentality, isn't it better for it just to be out in the open? That's the only way it'll change. That's why we should not regard Mulvaney's comments as a gaffe or another case of the Trump administration saying the quiet part loud and the loud part quiet. If Mulvaney's being truthful about how members of Congress view their relationship to deep-pocketed donors, and there's no reason to think he's lying, then that doesn't mean there's not a problem here. After all, by one count, there was $6.5 billion spent on the presidential and congressional elections in 2016, shattering the previous record of $6 billion that was spent in 2012, which in turn broke the previous record that was set in 2008, and so on and so forth. This is not going to stop, even though it would seem like every dollar spent on getting someone elected to public office could be put to better use by doing almost literally anything else with it. But the money keeps flowing in, which can only mean one thing. All that spending is paying off in some way. Politically powerful special interests don't get to be politically powerful by wasting their resources, after all. But what should we do about this? That's really the big question here. One option might be to make more rules governing money in politics. And already, in response to Mulvaney's comments, you heard a lot of people saying that's what we need. But the people making those rules will, after all, be the very same individuals that are already supposedly compromised by the current system. And more practically, the current Supreme Court is pretty unlikely to reverse the Citizens United ruling that opened the floodgates to large donations in politics. And even if the court did review that case, campaign finance rules don't actually stop political rent seeking. They just redirect it into other channels and actually sometimes increase corruption. So rules and structure can't keep money from influencing politics. This is pretty obviously true. Ironically enough, it's true even in the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the very agency that Mulvaney now runs. The CFPB was designed to be completely insulated from the political process. It doesn't even get its budget from Congress, but is rather funded directly from the Federal Reserve. That was meant to keep banking special interests from buying off the lawmakers who ultimately control the purse strings. Or so it was thought. Those rules actually just made the CFPB unaccountable to Congress, and they obviously have not shielded the agency from political influence, something that even Warren would surely have to admit now after her campaign to get Mulvaney fired from the office's headquarters. The only way to get money out of politics, it turns out, is to get politics out of money. That's easier said than done, of course, but unwinding the federal government's ability to influence corporate balance sheets is really the only way to keep those corporations from trying to use the government to do exactly that. If you're upset about Mulvaney's remarks this week, or in general upset about the influence of money in politics, and you believe he is telling the truth about government for, by, and of the lobbyists who gave us money, then the only solution is a less powerful government. Because when politicians no longer have the ability to make or break a business, those businesses will spend their money trying to influence the people who do. And that's us, the consumers. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We'll catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The U.S. Senate needs to work more days each week to clear the backlog of federal judges awaiting confirmation. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Here's a radical idea. As part of the campaign to make America great again, let's make Congress work again. It's not hard to explain. Both houses of Congress don't work as hard as our American citizens have a right to expect them to work. They take masses of time off under the sweet-sounding euphemism of district or state work days. A more honest term would be district campaign days, if not outright vacation time. The Senate, however, has one constitutional duty that the House of Representatives does not share, namely the approval of presidential appointments to the executive branch, plus judicial nominations. And that's exactly where I want us to focus for the next few minutes, the increasingly dysfunctional Senate confirmation process. The Senate is governed by a more arcane set of rules than most of us can imagine. Some of those rules are commendable in the way that they protect the minority party's interest, such as the filibuster rule and the 30-hour debate rule. But the way that they are being implemented is absurd. If the minority party wants to insist on 30 hours of debate for each nominee, then they should be required to stand on the floor of the Senate and truly hold forth for that full 30 hours. That would get old quickly. But that's not the way it happens now. The minority party simply indicates that they will insist on the full 30 hours, and then they do nothing except watch the clock for most of that time. That's an insult to every American taxpayer and voter. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell rightly accuses the Senate Democrats as obstructionists who exploit this rule to slow down the appointment confirmation process so much that it could take as long as 11 years to get all of President Trump's nominees through the process. 11 years when the president's term is only 4, and assuming that the Senate did nothing else, which is another absurdity. Now, there are a lot of conservatives who don't like Mitch McConnell, but I'm not one of them. I respect him and his knowledge of the Senate rules, but I do not support the way he is implementing them. If the Democrats are going to insist on stretching out each nominee for the full 30 hours, then Senator McConnell should respond by stretching out the Senate work week to the full 24/7, or 168 hours. What is it now? It's about 2.5 days. If the Senate stayed in session continuously for a week, including the weekend, they could confirm up to 5 nominees every week, even if the Democrats made them run the full 30-hour post-cloture time on each nomination. Democrats may be able to delay consideration of nominees for a short time, but they ultimately can no longer obstruct. Which party would be advantaged and which party would be disadvantaged by such a draconian dictate? The Republicans have only 9 seats to defend this year, while the Democrats have 26. So keeping senators in Washington for 5 days of each session week, or 7 days, would hurt more incumbent Democratic than Republican senators' time available to campaign to defend their seats. If there's one thing Mitch McConnell wants more than anything else in 2018, it is for Republicans to hold the Senate majority so that he may continue as Senate Majority Leader. I cannot for the life of me understand why Senator McConnell doesn't exploit this and keep the Senate in session longer. The Senate plays a critical constitutional role in helping the president shape and implement his priorities by confirming the president's nominations. I urge the Senate to act with haste to confirm the individuals that President Trump has selected to assist him in carrying out his mandate. To that end, the Conservative Action Project, of which I'm a member, on behalf of the conservative movement, calls on Majority Leader McConnell to immediately schedule committee and floor action every Thursday and Friday for the foreseeable future to act on President Trump's nominees for executive and judicial nominees and to begin working a full week every week until all nominations have been acted upon. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include KADA-FM in Ada, Oklahoma, WTRV-FM in Walker, Michigan, along with WTWZ-FM in Jackson, Mississippi. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.